Chapter 9. The Future. The past history of bacteria has been difficult enough to uncover, let alone making valid predictions for the future. The benefits of research into the molecular biology of bacteria. The genomic sequencing of bacteria is still in its infancy when we consider the vast number of bacterial species on the planet. It has identified the genes many bacteria species require, not only to survive, but to progress into new niches. The more genomic sequences of each species that are completed, the more comprehensive a map of their evolution will be obtained. We have, however, less knowledge on how these genes are controlled and what stimulates them to function. This is crucial information, because it may allow the control of pathogenic bacteria infections with drugs other than the conventional antibiotics used today. For instance, if the stimulus to the gene that makes a bacterium pathogenic can be inhibited, then it may be restrained without the need to kill it. This will, however, require very detailed molecular analysis. A constraint to the successful management of patients has been the speed at which diagnostic laboratories can identify a pathogen and its antibiotic susceptibility. Currently, it takes 1 or 2 days, during which time the patient has already been given therapy, which may be altered subsequently according to the test results. Molecular biological techniques are much faster and can, in theory, provide a result within an hour or two, which is within the prescribing time frame. Whereas it is now straightforward and fairly rapid to identify the pathogen by these techniques, the current limitation is to translate current molecular information into predicting individual bacterial susceptibility and likely clinical success. Future extensive genomic analysis should ultimately deliver this, though when is less certain. Bacteria as a cause of disease. In the past 30 years, there have been a number of spectacular and important discoveries where bacteria have been found to be the cause of disease. Helicobacter pylori and Legionella pneumophila, both discussed earlier, are two examples of where a bacterial vector of disease was unknown and unpredicted, which suggests that there are more bacteria of which we currently have no knowledge that can cause disease. We have to some extent been limited by the technology we have available, and this is increasingly based on molecular techniques. These are usually based on DNA analysis, which will recognize known sequences. However, if the sequences have never been described before, no DNA-based technique will identify them. Therefore, it may become increasingly difficult to find new pathogens. There are suggestions, currently without extensive proof, that bacteria play an important role in heart disease. This has been coupled with concerns that poor oral hygiene could lead to cardiovascular disease as the mouth bacteria spread into the rest of the body. These are still areas of speculation, but it has been reported that Chlamydia pneumoniae is probably associated with heart disease, as it has a coat protein that mimics a protein found in the heart muscle of mammals. The epidemiological evidence is compelling, as both Chlamydia pneumoniae and heart disease are common in humans. But is it really cause and effect? There are clearly going to be many more questions such as this in the future. The greatest fear is the emergence of new bacterial pathogens that have as devastating an effect as the Black Death. This has occurred with viruses, such as the pandemic caused by COVID-19, but could bacteria do the same? The circumstances are not the same as they were during the plague pandemics. Our environment is cleaner, our dwellings are more self-contained, and our lives are spent in less close proximity with our neighbours than they were even before the Second World War. The spread of COVID-19, however, suggests that if there is widespread movement of people, a pandemic could occur. A pandemic bacterium would almost certainly have to be respiratory, like COVID-19, as other methods of transmission are largely contained with modern food production, effective sewage disposal, and so on. This would mean that it would manifest itself within the cities first, and then perhaps along the transport routes by rail and by air. The COVID-19 outbreak showed how the governments of the world do not always react quickly once an outbreak is detected, but the chances of a major bacterial pandemic decimating the population in a vigilant society should be small. On the other hand, the emergence and widespread carriage of E. coli O157H7 in cattle, or Aeromonas salmonicida causing furunculosis in farmed salmon, shows that when we make some change, often quite small, to an environment, it can cause some major changes in the bacteria that emerge. E. coli O157H7 was unknown before farming practices changed after the Second World War. Its emergence probably resulted from changes in foodstuffs fed to these animals. Furunculosis does occur in wild salmon, but it is rare. Its emergence in farmed salmon is due entirely to the concentration of fish in a pen. Indeed, many new diseases in food-producing animals are related to the concentration of animals promoting spread. If the risks from bacteria in the future are not from new, hitherto unknown pathogens, but rather confined to other animals and perhaps the environment, where are the threats? Certainly, it can be from the animals themselves, known as zoonosis, as happens with flu or COVID-19. We are rapidly running out of antibiotics, and this is particularly acute with infections caused by gram-negative bacteria. As there is little likelihood of new antibiotics filling this niche in the near future, the task is not to find a new drug, but rather to find one that is safe, and that is proving almost impossible. Bacteria within the modern world. At some point in time, hopefully not until the distant future, this planet is likely to become uninhabitable for human life, and perhaps also for all vertebrates. Bacteria will survive, as they are the most flexible organisms, and evolve at a rate that allows rapid adaptation to all changes in the environment. In the shorter term, bacteria have to survive within the modern world. The speed at which new bacteria are identified suggests that we are still ignorant of most of the bacterial species on the planet. In the past 30 years, huge numbers of new bacterial species have been identified. This has been partly because we are better able to identify and distinguish unique bacterial species, largely because we are able to analyze their DNA. However, it has also resulted from our ability to explore new environments that were previously inaccessible. A notable example is Halomonas titanicae, a bacterium found in the rusticles of the wreck of the RMS Titanic, 3,800 meters below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean. However, these bacteria do not operate alone, and the formation of rusticles requires a consortium of other, often unknown, bacteria. If these bacteria thrive on iron, how do they normally survive at those depths in the absence of a wreck? We surely do not know. Probably the most unlikely place to find bacteria is in volcano vents and acid springs, mainly Archaea and Bejetoa, which can thrive in mud volcanoes. These environments, highly toxic to almost all animals and plants, have provided a niche for bacteria. These bacteria do not have the traditional requirements for carbon or even sunlight. They can survive on sulfur and hydrogen. One organism, Sulfolobus sulfataricus, can thrive in temperatures as high as 88 degrees Celsius and in very acidic conditions. They can also survive in the volcanic vents deep under the sea. Bacteria have been found in both the Arctic and Antarctic. About 7% of the Earth's surface is covered in sea ice, and bacteria are able to live and reproduce in it. There are four main phylogenetic groups of bacteria: the proteobacteria, the Cytophaga flavobacterium bacteroides, CFB group, and what are known as the high and low mol percent gram-positive bacteria, high and low referring to the proportion of guanine and cytosine residues in their DNA. However, many novel groups are continuously being discovered, including Polaromonas and Polaribacter. Interestingly, there are closely related sacrophilic or cryophilic, cold-loving, bacteria in Arctic and Antarctic sea ice, which raises the question as to how they were able to pass and survive through the tropics. The most likely explanation is that they passed between the two during one of the ice ages. The Antarctic is considerably colder, as the ice rests above a huge landmass. Bacteria have been found in ice taken from the South Pole itself, a remarkable achievement of survival, as they have to contend with temperatures as low as minus 89 degrees Celsius and an altitude on the ice shelf of 2,800 metres. Many of the polar bacteria may be found as spores that could survive for up to a million years, longer than most ice ages, thus allowing bacteria from one interglacial period to thrive in the next. The bacteria that survive would not necessarily have to be spores. A study of ice from Ellesmere Island in the high Canadian Arctic revealed large numbers of bacteria within the glaciers, some of them at least 2,000 years old. Many of these bacteria, however, have been in suspended animation, awaiting a change in climate. Recent innovations allow deep penetration into the Antarctic ice. A pool containing unfrozen water at minus 10 degrees Celsius with a high saline concentration was found beneath 500 metres of ice in the Taylor Glacier. The bacterium Thiomicrospira arctica was one of 17 new types living in the pool. Although similar to some marine bacteria, these bacteria have managed to survive in the absence of either oxygen or sunlight that might have allowed photosynthesis. They manage to respire with the iron deposits in the rock under the pool and appear to have survived on other living organisms cohabiting in the pool. Bacteria such as these can give an understanding of how bacteria survived the ice ages and suggest that they could survive on other planets and moons in the solar system. Will we find new bacterial species on other planets? That is not really possible to answer at the moment. The seeking of ancient waterways and the gathering of soil samples on the surface of the planet Mars led to speculation that the planet may have had sufficient water, the prerequisite for life as we understand it, at some point. Furthermore, the discovery that there may have been bacteria-like structures, which have been given the name Gillivinia strata, provided additional support for this view. However, this evidence remains inconclusive. The ALH84001 meteorite was expelled from Mars 17 million years ago and fell onto Antarctica 11,000 years ago. Electron microscopy of the meteorite reveals some bacteria-like structures, but it is unclear whether these come from the meteor or from extended exposure to the Antarctic environment. The Shergotti meteorite, also originating from Mars, was collected in India almost immediately after it fell, and examination showed evidence of microbial biofilms. There is currently no firm evidence identifying bacteria on the surface of Mars itself, but it is known that bacteria from the Earth have survived for some years on the surface of the Moon, although no indigenous bacteria from the Moon have been identified. So it is possible for bacteria to survive outside the confines of Earth, and it is extremely likely that they do exist somewhere. With this wealth of bacterial species, it is likely that some of them will come into direct competition with man. The iron-devouring bacteria certainly can cause significant damage to structures such as oil rigs and bridges, but their effects have been relatively slow, and they are unlikely to cause us major concern. Bacteria able to consume and detoxify oil, particularly after spillages, could be especially welcome. After the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in April 2010, an estimated 800 million litres of oil was released into the Gulf of Mexico. Approximately 25% was burned or skimmed off the sea surface, leaving a vast quantity of hydrocarbons. These were quickly digested by marine bacteria, such as Alcanivorax borcumensis. This resulted in a bacterial bloom. There was wide use of chemical dispersants, often mistakenly believed to break the oil up so it drops to the ocean floor. Indeed, their main role was to break up the oil so that the bacteria could use the hydrocarbons. It was estimated that these bacteria removed over 50% of the available oil. Bacteria need more than the carbon source of the oil. They require nitrogen and phosphorus, and there was not a sufficient supply of these for the bacteria to remove the rest of the oil. These nutrients are usually supplied in the ocean by fluvial deposits. As time progresses, sufficient quantities of these nutrients will enter the ocean to remove all but the largest chain hydrocarbons. There is increased interest in using bacteria such as these for boosting the yield of hydrocarbons from traditional oil wells. It is usually possible to extract 20 to 50% of the hydrocarbons from a conventional oil well. Then the pressure drops and it becomes more difficult to extract the oil. Techniques such as pumping in steam or carbon dioxide under pressure have been used to increase the amount extracted. These are expensive and inefficient. In some cases, the oil deposits have been degraded by microbial action, particularly on a water-oil interface. The product has been methane and carbon dioxide. Methane is the primary constituent of natural gas, and it has been proposed that bacteria should be used to convert these hydrocarbons into this convenient, easily extracted energy source. The Canadian government has funded a large project to identify and map the genes of the bacteria capable of turning oil into methane. This technology may be progressed further in an attempt to stem global warming. The atmospheric greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, can be captured and converted into methane by the bacterium Rhodopseudomonas palustris, effectively reversing combustion. Genetically modified bacteria. Half a century ago, it became possible to excise genes out of bacterial cells and splice them into other bacteria. With the appropriate genetic control machinery in place, it was then possible for these spliced genes to be expressed and to confer the characteristic they carried on their new host bacterium. In essence, many of these early experiments were similar to the genetic manipulations that were occurring naturally as bacteria transferred DNA in the form of plasmids from one cell to another. The technique became more sophisticated as the genes were specifically excised by restriction enzymes and spliced not into known clinical plasmids, but rather into small, artificially created plasmids. These tended to be small, up to 10,000 nucleotides long, and were thus too small either to be self-transferable or to be controllable by the bacterial cell itself. These small, genetically constructed plasmids were transformed into their new bacteria hosts. In other words, the DNA itself was inserted into the cell, either by making the cell competent, amenable to the uptake of naked DNA, or by electroporation, where the DNA inserts through holes generated by a short electric shock. The consequence of the lack of control was that once inside, the plasmid DNA was able to replicate until there might be more than 200 copies per cell. This meant that there was much more DNA that could be transcribed and translated into protein, so the yield of the protein could be boosted 20-fold or more. There was no theoretical limit to the genes that could be inserted into this type of plasmid. They did not necessarily have to come from other bacteria, but could come from viruses, plants, animals, or even ourselves. This raised huge concerns that the insertion of a rogue gene in the wrong bacterium could have devastating biological consequences for ourselves and the planet as a whole. A moratorium was called, and rigid restrictions imposed on the type of experiments that can be performed. Nowadays, these types of genetic manipulations are under strict control. A risk assessment has to be made, outlining what the potential threats are if these bacteria were to escape into the community. Unfortunately, individual countries interpret this differently, and some have allowed the creation of some bacteria with potentially hazardous genes, with few or no containment restrictions. On the positive side, there are many benefits to genetically engineered genes. An often cited example is the movement away from the use of animal-derived insulin for injection by diabetic patients. In the 1980s, the gene encoding human insulin was cloned into a plasmid, which was inserted into an E. coli strain. Culturing the bacterium in large quantities enabled high yields of insulin, which was then purified for medical use. Genetically engineered insulin now accounts for the vast majority of insulin currently used, but there are concerns that the purification of the protein from the E. coli can allow some transfer of bacterial debris and may cause problems with allergy. Perhaps a greater concern is whether the three-dimensional structure of genetically engineered insulin, although generated from the same DNA, is actually identical to natural human insulin. Its structure is dependent on its amino acids, and thus of the DNA itself, and its environment, dependent on solute concentrations, temperature and pH. The two chains of insulin are generated in bacteria, and they have come from a completely different environment from that produced in animals. They are mixed to form the final molecule, but it is argued that this is not identical in shape to insulin produced in animals and cannot perform the same tasks as efficiently. However, recent advances in protein structure prediction are likely to settle this issue. This technology has been taken further where the genes encoding the human growth hormone have been inserted into bacteria and harvested directly. The previous alternative for a single dose was to extract this hormone from the pituitary glands of 50 deceased individuals. The production of tissue plasminogen activator, which dissolves blood clots, has now been taken over by bacterial genetic engineering. An added advantage is that as the proteins are not produced in humans, they will not be contaminated with human viruses. This became critical when blood products were found to be contaminated with human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, and many haemophiliacs became infected using contaminated factor VIII. Factor VIII is also now made by recombinant technology, but in mice rather than bacteria. The traditional use of vaccines, particularly against viral infections, is to administer either an attenuated strain that does not cause severe infection, or a strain that is effectively dead and incapable of causing infection. Both rely on the fact that part of the whole virus particle is recognized as foreign, which becomes a target for the immune system and allows the memory T and B cells to generate specific antibodies. Both types of vaccine have disadvantages. The first is that a live virus is being administered, albeit presumed benign. The second is that a dead virus is being administered, usually at a much higher concentration, which can cause its own problems. It is argued that a much safer manufacture of vaccines would be to identify the epitopes of the virus that are the targets for the immune system and insert the DNA encoding their genes into the plasmids of bacteria. These are then cultured, and the relevant epitopes, usually proteins, are harvested and comprise the vaccine. An alternative, if seeking to produce a vaccine for a bacterial infection, is to genetically engineer the components of the bacterium. This has proved particularly successful with Streptococcus pneumoniae, which we have already seen has a protective capsule. However, there are many variants of this pathogen that can cause a variety of diseases, so a genetically engineered preparation has been made to cover the main variants. In one preparation, Prevnar 13, the capsule sugars from 13 variants, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6A, 6B, 7F, 9V, 14, 18C, 19A, 19F, 23F, are cultured separately, extracted, and conjugated onto a non-toxic protein carrier, CRM197, from Corynebacterium diphtheriae. This type of vaccination has been successful, which is encouraging, as conventional vaccines against bacteria have often been less successful than those against viruses. The use of recombinant DNA is not restricted to medical preparations. There are bacteria, for example Bacillus thuringiensis, that penetrate corn roots, and they have been used to insert a gene that produces an insect-killing toxin, thus making corn plants resistant to detrimental insects. The genetic manipulation of the genes within Pseudomonas syringae has lowered the temperature at which water freezes around them. As these bacteria adhere to plants, the presence of these modified bacteria can prevent frost damage around the roots of some plants. Synthetic bacteria. The progression from genetically modified bacteria could be the creation of a completely synthetic bacterium. It is possible to create genes in a nucleotide synthesizer and splice them together to form a genome. If this is inserted into a bacterial cell which has had its DNA removed, the bacterium takes the characteristics determined by the DNA introduced into it. This act of science fiction became science fact in May 2010, when it was announced that a chemically created genome had been inserted into Mycoplasma mycoides by the J. Craig Venter Institute. This was no mean feat, because large sections of DNA had to be inserted into the cell. Once inside the new bacterium, named JCVI-SYN1, the DNA was able to replicate and the cells were able to divide. In other words, bacterial life had been created and satisfied a major criterion of a living organism, its ability to reproduce. The possibilities that this technology brings are huge, and we are entering a new era of synthetic and semi-synthetic bacteria that should be able to perform large numbers of different, hitherto unknown, engineering and medical tasks, the extent of which is probably only limited by our imagination. In 2019, Jason Chin and colleagues at the MRC Molecular Biology Laboratory in Cambridge constructed a complete DNA chromosome for Escherichia coli, building a synthetic genome four times larger and far more complex than any previously created. These unusually shaped bacteria are alive and are able to reproduce themselves, albeit slowly, but their cells operate according to a new set of biological rules, producing familiar proteins with a reconstructed genetic code. They are the world's first living, self-replicating organism with entirely synthetic and radically redesigned DNA. The initial aim of the construction was to understand the parameters involved in the production of proteins encoded by DNA, but bacteria such as these have many possibilities. They may be constructed to produce new medicines. There are, however, potential ethical and environmental arguments against creating organisms such as these. The obvious one is the malicious creation of pathogenic bacteria for terrorist purposes that are more virulent and persistent than the bacteria that we currently know. It would be theoretically possible to create bacteria that have a very low dose of infectivity, so that only one or two cells could lead to a fatal infection. The bacteria could be made more resilient, so that they could be combined into an explosive. Gruesome as the prospect of these bacteria might be, perhaps the greatest fear is that a bacterium would be created that would possess properties that had not been predicted, or that a virulent bacterium escaped. These bacteria would not necessarily have to be directed at humans, but some rogue bacterium could contaminate the environment, the domestic food animal population, or even our fuel sources. Although our capacity to manipulate bacterial DNA has reached an extraordinary degree of sophistication, our knowledge of epidemiology and the ability to predict how new strains of bacteria will survive, either in the environment or as pathogens, is far less impressive. We simply do not know why some bacteria proliferate and others do not. Until we have acquired the ability to model how individual bacteria strains survive and prosper, the release of synthetically created or new and largely unknown natural bacteria has the potential, at least, to provide us with some nasty surprises unless we are very careful. This concludes Bacteria by Sebastian Ames, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Copyright 2022 by Sebastian G.B. Ames. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2022 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.